Baba preferred Zulu servants. She said they had been disciplined warriors. They were obedient, conscientious, and fiercely loyal. Their society was built on loyalty. They had had great autocratic rulers who were astute military strategists and who conquered much territory in a series of bloody wars. There was Dingaan. There was Dingiswayo. There was the cruel Shaka, who armed his men with short, stabbing spears and made them walk barefoot for greater speed and mobility. He taught them new military tactics and obliged them to remain celibate until they were 40. He ordered his impis to walk off a cliff to prove their loyalty. They were our Prussians, Mother said. Mother preferred the men to the women because, she said, they worked even harder, did not fall pregnant, did not indulge in unnecessary chatter, and did not hesitate to perform whatever was asked of them. They rose before dawn to brush the carpets, to polish the silver and the floors, piling all the furniture in the middle of the room. They scrubbed the kitchen floor on their knees. When they served at table, they dressed in starched white jackets and trousers, which rustled as they floated quietly and efficiently about in soft sand shoes. Red sashes ran slantwise across their chests, from shoulder to waist, and ended in tassels that dangled on their hips like decorations of valor. They wore white gloves and tapped an opener against the bottle to ask us what we would like to drink. The Zulu my sister and I loved best was John Mazaboko. He called my sister Katie because of the initials on her silver christening bowl, which he polished almost into oblivion. Whenever he saw her, he'd chuckle, as though they shared some secret understanding. We followed him around the house and watched him as he polished the floors, and the furniture, and the shoes, even the soles of the shoes. He was unusually tall, and so strong he was able to catch the ancient armoire when it fell forward and almost crushed my sister as a small child. But his hands were gentle. Mother said he could not bear to hear us cry when we were babies and would beg the severe Scottish nanny to allow him to hold us in his arms. He taught us how to ride bicycles and ran down the bank beside my sister under the flamboyance, waving the dishcloth at her and shouting, "Gashly, gashly, Katie," warning her to watch out as she wobbled along. He told us stories about the Tokolosh, the evil spirit who lived in the fish pond at the bottom of the garden. He told us all the jacarandas in the garden were good, except for the last one on the left, which was bad. We never went near it. He was the one my sister called when she accidentally stepped on her beloved little budgerigar, a small, brightly colored parrot, which lay flapping its broken wings on the floor. He took its pulsing neck between his fingers and wrung it swiftly. "Better like this," he told her. He brought us freshly squeezed orange juice in the early mornings, entering the nursery with a tray and the newspaper for the nanny, drawing back the lined curtains to let light into the room, and wishing us a good morning with a grave savona. Once, the Scottish nanny, a diminutive woman known as a white nanny to distinguish her from the black ones, summoned him to clean the inside of a malodorous cupboard. Wrinkling her nose, she said, "It smells Zulu." He bent down from his great height onto his hands and knees and scrubbed the closet clean. After our father's death, our mother withdrew, closed many of the rooms in the house, draped the furniture with sheets, and gradually fired all the other servants. Even the Scottish nanny was fired for stealing Mother's knitting needles and hiding them under her mattress so that Mother would not find them. The nanny slammed the door behind her and mumbled, "These children would be better off in an orphanage." Only John remained. It was South Africa in the 40s, and he was looking after two little girls and their mother. He seemed sad. "He's not too pleased," Mother told us. "He's actually a bit of a snob, you know."